And if you don't have a Bible, you'll probably want one. And if you don't have one of the handouts we've been using periodically, maybe David would, if you signal if you didn't bring them or don't have them. I don't see too many that haven't been here. Dave, you might need them. Or come up and get your own, whichever you'd rather do. Zephaniah. Okay, as we said just briefly last night, as we had a few moments before we ended our discussion, Zephaniah means God has hidden. And Zephaniah was a writing prophet who wrote primarily to Judah and would have been contemporary. As you look on this one chart, you can kind of see that he's considered to be contemporary or very close to Nahum and Jeremiah. Around Habakkuk, I covered Habakkuk before I covered Zephaniah. If you come to the conclusion you think he was a little bit ahead of Habakkuk, I don't have a problem with that. The main thing is we keep these people historically close enough that we can identify the historical events that occurred around their prophesying, which will help us to understand. And you'll remember that I mentioned that one of the unique things about the book of Zephaniah is he's the only prophet that traces his ancestry back four generations. And we either don't know why he did that, or the last one, Hezekiah, may be the king Hezekiah, so he may have been wanting to show his lineage to the king. I happen to personally think that's highly probable, but I'm certainly not contentious about it because we don't know for sure. We also notice that he prophesied during the reign of King Josiah, and King Josiah reigned from about 640 B.C. down to 609, so very close to the captivity, or at least the first wave of captivity. And we mentioned last night that as we were closing that one of the things that occurred in the 18th year of King Josiah's reign was they discovered the law of the Lord that had been lost. And one of the paradoxical things, I think, in the Bible is that it had been lost in the house of the Lord. And we left with the thought, could the law, Word of God be lost in the house of God? And I think on somewhat of a rhetorical note, because it won't be physically lost in the house of the Lord today, but it could be spiritually lost, and we need to be ever vigilant about that. Okay, now we'll continue with the book of Zephaniah, and I'll give you a few more things to consider and then open it up for comments and questions. But one of the themes we're going to begin to see now in Zephaniah is this concept of the day of the Lord. We're also going to see Joel addressing it, and we didn't touch on it, but I'll probably go back and touch on it. Amos is actually the first writing prophet to use the phrase day of the Lord as its outline. And the Jews considered the day of the Lord at that time would be the day that God would come and take vengeance on their enemies. And this was a common mindset of the Jews. I believe they even felt that way somewhat when Jesus came, because they were continually looking for a Messiah that would come and free them from Rome and punish the enemies of Israel. Well, God said he would punish the enemies of Israel, but what the Jews didn't understand or didn't recognize is that he promised not only would he punish the enemies of Judah and Israel, he would punish Judah and Israel when they were disobedient. So when they start thinking of the day of the Lord, they're thinking of a liberating force that's going to come and conquer their enemies. And one of the jobs of the prophets, and especially the minor prophets, although Isaiah, I think, also touches on this, was to try to tell the Jews the day of the Lord is going to be a two-edged sword, because he's going to be, on some of those occasions, punishing your enemies, but he's going to be, on some of those occasions, punishing you. Those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat the past. That's one of the great sayings that's come out of history, and I think it's one of the great truisms. Okay, let's go back now to chapter 1 and begin to pick up a few key points as we go through the book of Zephaniah. And Zephaniah here is probably writing a little bit before the destruction or captivity of Jerusalem by the Babylon Babylonians, and therefore we're going to see much of his discussion and much of his usage of the phrase Day of the Lord is going to have to do with the Babylonian invasion. But he starts out with some very strong words in verse 2 from God. I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith the Lord. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of heaven and the fishes of the sea and the stumbling blocks with the wicked. And I will cut off man from off the land, saith the Lord. Now he's talking about the promised land here, as I understand it, because God did not cut off all of the land. But it's interesting as you go down through verses 2, 3, that it appears that when the judgment or the wrath of God came, and it did come on Jerusalem and Judah, it was not simply going to affect men, it was going to affect all of God's creation. He says it's going to affect the fowls, it's going to affect the fishes, it's going to affect the stumbling blocks or those people that have tried to pull the righteous away. It's going to affect the beasts. God's creation has always seems to have been affected by man's sin. You remember that passage in Romans that says the whole creation groans? And I believe that groaning of the whole creation that Paul talks about in the book of Romans was due to the sin of Adam and Eve. Because not only did the sin of Adam and Eve lead to the spiritual fall and decay of man, it seems to have led to some change in God's creation. And they're looking for the day when that will no longer be. There's a couple of interesting phrases I'll just point out to you in verses 4 and verse 5. In the latter part of verse 4, the name of the Chimerims with the priest. And as I understand that phrase, Chimerims, that's a Syrian priest title. So we're talking about false priests here. We're talking about apostasy, and that's going to be wiped out. And then the last part of verse 5, we have the phrase Malcolm. That's the way I pronounce it anyway. And that's the same as you'll find other places in the Bible called Moloch, M-O-L-E-C-H. And it was the god to whom they would sacrifice their infant children to. They would heat up this image of Moloch so that he was fire hot. And then he was made in such a way that he had two hands out in front of him. And when those hands got red hot, they would lay their infant children in the hands of the idol Moloch as a form of worship. Now that sounds incredible to us, and it is. I hope it does sound incredible to us. But let me just tell you that I believe as repulsive as what I just described is to us, all sin is that repulsive to God. Some sin offends our senses more. You know, some maybe the sin of homosexuality or perversions or infant sacrifice, that offends us maybe a little bit more, but I'm persuaded that that's how bad God feels about all sin. So that's something for us to keep in mind as we go throughout our lives. Beginning with verse 7, God tells the people to hold the peace at the presence of the God, for the day of the Lord is at hand. And that phrase, is at hand, I think is important, because some people would like to take this concept in the minor prophets of the day of the Lord and extend it always to the end of time. But I believe this phrase is talking, when it says it's at hand, is talking about something that was fairly near in its occurrence. And I think, in fact, it was talking about the destruction of the temple and destruction of Jerusalem. And it's an interesting phrase in the last half of verse 7. It says, for the Lord hath prepared a sacrifice, and he hath bid his guests. Now, who or what was the sacrifice of God, and who were the guests that God was inviting? My understanding of that is the sacrifice that God was going to be offering here would literally be Judah or Jerusalem. And the guest would be, he's inviting the other countries around to watch what's going to happen to even his people when they're disobedient. Because when we get to some of the other books, as we have seen, Zechariah and Obadiah, there's warnings to the other nations. Well, here he's saying, you other nations, and he calls them guests here in verse 7, you watch what's going to happen to my people And let that be a lesson, because if you think I wouldn't do it to you, well, rest assured I would if I'm willing to do it to my people. And that's exactly what it is. But the concept of the Lord preparing a sacrifice is kind of an oddity to us, because we think of man sacrificing to God. But here we have the terminology of God sacrificing his people, not in an unjust way, but in a way that is true to their justice. In verse 10, some of you that have been to Israel can appreciate this more. If I've got the right verse. Yeah, it is. It shall come to pass in that day, the day of the Lord, saith the Lord, that there shall be a noise of cry from the fish gate. Now, some of you can help me. I don't know if the fish gate is still open or not. I know all of the gates aren't open. But the fish gate was one of the gates that we see later that Nehemiah put back into the wall of Jerusalem. And it's on the northern side of the wall of Jerusalem. So if you've got the wall, just think of it as kind of a rectangle, although I know it's not. The fish gate was on the northern side. So here when he says that the noise and cry shall come from the fish gate, I believe he's alluding to the Babylonian invasion, which would come from the north. So they may have actually come into the fish through the fish gate, but they certainly came to Jerusalem from the north. Okay? And that allusion here makes me feel certainly that the day of the Lord is talking about the imminent invasion of Jerusalem. But I find that interesting. I can't remember. There was 10 or 11 gates, I think, originally. And I think someone was telling me they only really have 5 or 6 now. I don't know just how many. There was. There may not.
Yeah. On the east side, there's Stephen's Gate and the Golden Gate, which is closed up. On the south, there's the Dung Gate and the Zion Gate. On the west, there's Damascus.
Yeah. If you want a reference from Nehemiah on the Fish Gate, it's Nehemiah. It's Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 3, talks about when they put the fish gate in. So that's kind of an interesting chapter or two to read back in Nehemiah, because they have these neat names, descriptive names, I should say, for the various gates. Some of them are neat and some of them are just plain descriptive. But I think that's what he's referring to there in verse 10. Okay, then down in verse 12, we see that I will search Jerusalem. I think this is Zephaniah, or he's going to search Jerusalem with candles. I wanted to point that out for three reasons. This 12th verse is very interesting. Number one, this is a thorough search of Jerusalem that's going to be made, because he says, I'm going to do it with a candle, or I'm going to do it with light. Now, you understand that candle is a translation there, because they didn't have candles back in those days. It was several centuries before they had tallow candles. So what they had was a lamp that contained oil. It doesn't really make a difference here in verse 12, but there are some passages in the Old Testament that if you take candle to mean candle like we think, you'll miss the meaning of what's being said. And he says he's going to search those who have been punished. And in the last phrase, it says, he's searching for them who say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. Now that's a reference very close to what we today call deism, or a deistic belief. And deism is the belief that God created the world, but once he created the world, he has nothing to do with it. Since he set everything in motion and then he stays back, he's not involved in any plan of salvation. There's no interreaction between man and God. There's no worship necessary. It's a fatalistic type of a view. And although he doesn't call them deists, because that's a modern term, I think that phrase tells us that there were people who thought the Lord's not doing good and he's not doing bad. He's just totally uninvolved since the creation. And that's a very appealing doctrine to people today, but it's also a very dangerous doctrine, because it absolves them in their minds of responsibility to God. And we know that God doesn't say that at all. He said that he is involved in our lives and he is continuing to do good and he will punish the evil. That's the reoccurring theme of the minor prophets as well as the rest of the Bible. But to take the position that he's not involved and isn't involved in the things that are going on and is not going to be involved in the future is a very non-biblical view. Okay. Let's look a little bit now at chapter 2. Chapter 2 is an urgent call to repent. And you see this time and time again. Gather yourselves together. I guess if we were translating that today, I'd say get a grip on yourself or get your act together. Gather yourselves together. Yea, gather together, O nation not desired, before the decree or the cry of judgment comes forth. It's a passionate plea by Zephaniah to Jerusalem, get your act together, because God has selected who's going to punish you if you don't. There's an interesting thing that occurs in verse 4. He lists four towns in verse 4. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron. Now those were four Philistine cities. Now there was five great Philistine cities. And it's interesting to me that he probably left out the one that we're most likely to remember. Now, this is a bit of trivia, but the one he left out here was Gath. And the reason we might remember Gath is that was the hometown of Goliath. And I also find this interesting because back in Amos chapter 1, verse 6, Amos lists four out of five Philistine cities, and he lists the same four that Zephaniah does and leaves out Gath. I don't know if there's any significance to that at all, whether Gath was less prominent during the writings of these and after Goliath's defeat it lost stature, or whether it was just a coincidental thing, but I found that interesting, and if any of you find anything to maybe shed light on why that might be, because back in the times of Saul and David, it lists five. And you remember these were some of the cities that when the Ark of the Covenant was stolen, they went around and around to, and some of the men in one of these cities got hemorrhoids from having the Ark, and some of them had calamities. But it's just interesting to me that Zephaniah mentions the same four out of five that Amos mentions, and they leave the same one out. Okay. Then in verses 8 through 11, we come back to Moab and Ammon. And who did we say the other night that the nations of Moab and Ammon were descendants of? Lot. They were from the relationship that Lot's daughters, and they never seemed to have good favor, partly from that. Okay. So then in verses 8 through 11, he talks about Moab and Ammon. In verses 12 through 14, we find him talking about the Ethiopians and the Assyrians. And most people think this phrase Ethiopian is really referring to the African countries rather than just the country that we call Ethiopia. But whether you do or you don't, he's including the Philistine country, Moab, the Ammonites, the Ethiopians, and the Assyrians, all in the fact that they're not going to escape judgment. Then in chapter 3, he tells us that their reward will match their conduct. And that's one of the great consistencies of the Bible. People's rewards will always match their conduct. You get no choice on what your reward is. The choice every man and woman gets is what their conduct is. But once you select your conduct, your reward or punishment is locked in. So you and I can't choose in the strict sense. We can't choose heaven or hell. We can choose to be Christians or not Christians. But once we make the choice of conduct, then our reward or punishment is locked in. And that's exactly what he's telling these people. Your punishment is going to meet your conduct. And that's a consistent theme of God. So it's a great lesson for us to get out of the minor prophets as they talk. However, it just sounds just exactly like Paul in Galatians chapter 6. Is it verse 7? As you sow, so shall you reap. And so many people are not wanting to sow, but are planning on reaping. And God says that's a disconnect and it's simply not going to happen. One other thing I wanted to point out to you here in the book of Zephaniah, well, there's many things I'd like to point out to you, but one I want you to look at is in verse 9 of chapter 3. This is now, as many of the other prophets, he said, these are the bad things that are coming, but he always ends, they like to end on a stroke of hope. So, starting with verse 9, he tells us about the hope or some of the good things that are going to happen after the children come out of their exile. And he says in verse 9, "For then will I turn to the people a pure language, that they may call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent." I want to emphasize to you how God uses language. When he wants to pull people together, he gives them a common language or a common understanding. And when he wants to scatter people, he gives them diverse language. Now, you remember well what he did at the Tower of Babel. He changed their language and the people scattered. But let me ask you, what did he do when he wanted to bring people together to form the church? He allowed them to understand each other by giving the apostles the ability to speak in tongues. So when God wanted to disperse people, he confused their language. When he wants to bring people together, he unifies their language. And that's a great principle in the Bible. And he's telling them here that my people are going to have a unified language. It's going to be a pure language. Now, I think he's talking past whether you speak German or French or Spanish. He's talking about we're speaking the language of God. Otherwise, we're going to say only people that speak a certain language can be Christians. And we all understand that's absurd. But even when you come in contact with people that don't speak your language, if you're Christian brothers and sisters, you speak the same language in a more important. And I think that's what he's talking about here. I even wonder if this isn't a little bit what Paul meant to Titus when he talks to Titus and says, "I want you to have a sound doctrine or a sound speech." And Paul, I think, in other places used the phrase honest speech, which I think is excellent. And I just think that's a great way to describe his God's people coming back together. I'm going to give you a pure language. Tom?
I think of the passage in the Corinthian letter, Paul saying to speak the same thing.
Yeah.
Whether we're actually, I think of this in foreign work, whether we're there in Jerusalem using the Hebrew language, the English language, Finnish people, or Russian, we all have one common faith and we all speak the same thing, though it be with different national tongues.
If we have the one faith, then we have the one language. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Okay. A couple of other verses that are of interest. When God calls his people, he wants their language to be pure. When Isaiah was called to be a prophet, the coals came to the lips of Isaiah, and it says they sizzled in some translations. And God knows that it's our mouth that's usually the first sign of our difficulty spiritually. From the mouth comes what's inside the heart. Jeremiah said the same thing in Jeremiah 1:9, Daniel 10:16. All of those are examples of prophets that emphasize speaking through the lips and the mouth of God. And I think that's a wonderful lesson for us. We need to talk the language of the Lord. And when we do that, then we're a different people.
Amen. Speak, let him speak as the oracles of God.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so in Zephaniah, we can't spend too much time on it, we have warnings about the coming calamity, reference to the day in the Lord, but then the promise here in the last part of chapter 3 that I'm going to bring my remnant. He's not going to bring them all back. We're going to see a little bit later, not to get ahead of myself, that probably when they came across the Jordan River after wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, my best feeling is there was probably 2 or 3 million people. We know there were 600,000 fighting men, probably 2 or 3 or 4 million people if you just do the math. Every fighting man had a wife, and if they each had 2 kids, then that's probably low. But when they returned from the exile, there aren't 2 or 3 million anymore. There's about 55 total, maybe 50 to 55,000. And that's why God calls it the remnant. Any comments or questions? I apologize because I don't always stop and ask for them, but I want to give you the chance. And I just trust you to interrupt me when you've got a question or a comment because I want you to. Okay, let's go to Obadiah, and I'll give you a clue. You need to go back a little bit. Some of these are hard to find, but when they're only one chapter, they get real hard. And if your pages stick together, you're going to miss Obadiah. There's a lot of discrepancy about when Obadiah was written. And it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference as long as we're in the ballpark. You'll notice on the chart I give you, they list Obadiah as the first. I happen to think Obadiah was probably a little closer to Hosea and Micah, but I'm not contentious about that. But the message of Obadiah is to the Edomites. Now, who were the Edomites? Who did they descend from?
Esau.
Okay? And you remember that relationship of Jacob and Esau? It never was really a good relationship. And here's a lesson in parenting. You've got to take a lot of that malcontent between those two brothers back to their parents. Because you've got a situation there where the scripture says, and she loved Jacob and he loved Esau. And you all know that's a guaranteed formula for disaster. And while we all say with our mouths we love our children the same, some of our children are going to naturally have characteristics that attract us more than others. And as parents, you've got to be very careful. But in Genesis, as soon as you read that she loved Jacob and he loved Esau, you ought to be, as parents, know that that family's in trouble. And they were. Now, the brothers tried to patch it up a little bit when Jacob came back, but their descendants never really did be able to patch that up. And in fact, later, some 400 or 500 years ago, when the children of Israel were coming up out of Egypt, you remember they went to the Edomites and asked for passage in Numbers, and the Edomites refused them passage. And there was just hostility between God's people and the Edomites until David in Samuel actually conquered Edom and put barracks there or forts and really subdued them. But it was a hostile takeover. And there was always this conflict and clash between the Edomites and the children of God. All throughout the prophetic writings, the concept of Edom stands for non-spiritual or worldly people, because that's exactly what they were. And God tells us in Hebrews 12:16 what he thinks of Esau when he says, "He who for a mess of meat sold his own birthright." That's God's evaluation of Esau. So there's some parts of that story of Jacob and Esau that can evoke my sympathy for Esau, but it appears that his priorities and his value system wasn't very good. Just a little history on the Edomites that you may not be familiar with. They remained a nation down through about 100 A.D., and then they just disappear from the pages of history. They survived through the impending invasion by the Babylonians. They survived somewhat through the Maccabean era. But by about 100 A.D., they just dissolve as a nation. And I don't know where you'd go to find an Edomite. And God says this nation's not going to continue. And kind of to give you an indication of how pathetic this nation was, the most famous people that the Edomites produced were the Herods. Antipater, who was Herod the Great's father, was an Edomite. So when you look at a nation and you say your claim to fame is Herod the Great and his clan, that we know what they did, you've not got a very spiritual nation, I would say. And that's exactly what the Edomites were. Okay, let's look at a few of these things. Basically, the book of Obadiah tells us that Edom is going to fall, and it's going to fall, one, because it's a proud nation, and two, because it's been cruel to Israel. That's one thing God doesn't tolerate, is cruelty to his people, whether it's Israel or the church. In the long run, God's not going to tolerate that. Okay, let's read just a few verses. I'll start with the first one. The vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us arise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. In other words, God says, I made you an insignificant nation, and I made you to be despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the cliffs of the rocks, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Now, I don't know whether any of you have been to what used to be Edom. I doubt that most of the tourists go there, but it's down south of the Dead Sea. And it's a very mountainous area, as I understand it. And the Edomites took great pride in building their homes and towns up in these mountains, and they began to be proud of it and said, in essence, we're impregnable. Now, I want you to keep that in mind as we read some of these verses. And in fact, verse 3, when it says, you dwellest in the cliffs of the rock, that's exactly where they were. I guess it would be kind of like Mesa Verde, if any of you have been to Colorado and those Indians built their homes in the side, although I think this would have been more mountainous than Mesa Verde. Verse 4, thou hast exalted thyself as an eagle. Now, an eagle builds his nest up in the cliffs. And this is what they thought they had done. Thou hast set thy nest among the stars. Thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. Now, in the end of verse 3, the Edomites are saying, who shall bring me down to the ground? In the end of verse 4, God gives them an answer. I'm going to do it. But they were proud. They were thieves and robbers in verse 5. And Edom's destruction was finalized. Down in verse 9, he says, you mighty men of Teman. Now, Teman was one of the two major cities of Edom. It was slightly to the south of Selah, which was the other one. And he says in verse 10, their crime was violence against the people of God. I don't think when it says brother Jacob, he's talking just about Jacob, but he's talking about the descendants of Jacob, or the Israelites, as we understand them. In the day that thou stoodest, verse 11 is intriguing. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. Now I want you to grasp what he's saying. The Edomites didn't invade Jerusalem, but they stood by and watched as Jerusalem was invaded. And God says, because you simply stood by and watched, you're as guilty as if you'd done it. Now, I hope I don't have to probe your mind very hard to get a today lesson out of that. It's not simply when we do the sin that we're guilty of the sin. If we stand by and watch it and don't try to correct it, or God forbid we stand by and enjoy it, which was what the Edomites did about the invasion of Jerusalem, God says here, you're as guilty as if you did it. Now, we sometimes think that's a new concept that Jesus brought in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, if a man looketh after a woman to lust after her, it's as bad as if he had committed adultery. Well, right here he's saying, if you look at it and enjoy seeing someone harmed, even though you didn't do it, it's as bad as if you did it. That's a constant principle of God. And I think we need to consider that in our everyday life. Whether it's voyeurism or empathetic sin, it's still something to be avoided. Then in verse 12, he gives them three look nots. He gives them three nots. The first one is, look not, but thou shouldest not have looked on the day. They shouldn't have watched as Jerusalem was pilfered. And neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over what you saw. And neither shouldest thou spoken proudly of that day of distress. Here's a nation that didn't have the power to do what Babylon did, but they thoroughly enjoyed watching Babylon thrash the Jerusalem. And God says, you're as guilty as if you'd have done it yourselves. Okay. One of the best definitions of patience that I've ever heard is that a patient man is one who has the power to revenge but doesn't. If you don't have the power to do something and don't do it, that's not patience. That just means you're weak. A patient man who is the one who has the power to do it and is so loving that he doesn't do it. Okay, let's drop down and pick up just a few more things. Verse 17 through the end of the chapter again takes us back to Mount Zion. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance. Now the phrase Mount Zion, I believe, is used several ways in the Bible, but it always refers to God's stronghold. And sometimes Mount Zion is a direct reference to Jerusalem, which was on the mountain. Sometimes it's a reference to the church, and sometimes it may even be a reference to heaven. But it's always God's stronghold. So reading that into verse 17, but it says, "But upon God's stronghold shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions." In other words, it's in being with God that there is deliverance. And again, I sound like a broken record, but it's worth repeating. Another prophet who starts out with doom and gloom for some people, but ends on a note of hope. Because God always ends his message to man on a note of hope. Not to be confused that he won't vengefully go after people that are against him, but he always leaves out the essence of hope in his teaching. Any comments or questions on Obadiah? Anne? It could, because I believe Mount Zion is often used for Jerusalem or the church or heaven, and certainly his church was started. I think probably he's using the phrase Mount Zion here, although we don't grasp it because we're not familiar. One of the strongholds of Edom was Mount Seir, S-E-I-R. So he's really kind of saying there's no deliverance in Mount Seir, the deliverance is in Mount Zion, and he's contrasting the two. He doesn't quite come out and say that, but I think that's what he's saying. For these people, deliverance would have been in Jerusalem vis-a-vis the temple. For us, deliverance is the church vis-a-vis becoming a Christian. And for all of us, ultimately, the deliverance will be heaven. And I think you could apply the phrase Mount Zion equally correct to all of those, and you've got to look at the context to try to determine which it is. But if we mix those a little bit, we're not going to be very far off, because if I'm in the church, I'm almost in heaven. I'm not there as intensely as I will be, but I'm there as close as I can be in this flesh, so that's good enough for me. Anne? It could be. I think there's a tendency for those of us that have been schooled for years and years to forget that we always have new and young people coming up that need to go back to the basics. I think we need to be always vigilant about that. But I think it's a good comment. I don't really know how to... You really didn't ask me a question. I think it's just a good comment. Clark? Yeah, they came in and apparently participated in some looting of bounty, which was even worse. Good point. I didn't bring that out. David?
I want to back you up to something you said when you started on Obadiah.
Mm-hmm.
You said that Obadiah is regarding Edom, and you said it was fallen because of their cruelty to God's people, and what else did you say?
Pride. Yeah, you pick that up at the very second word in verse 3. The pride of thine heart hath delivered thee. The Edomites eventually, the Maccabees forced a lot of them to be circumcised, so they became proselyte Jews, and that was part of their disintegration as a nation, and the rest of them apparently just kind of filtered into the whole Arab world over there. But I don't know where you'd go to find an Edomite today, but like I said last night, it's no trouble finding a Jew. And I think there's a divine hand of God working there. Not that the Jews are positionally any different than the Gentiles now. Paul tells us they're not. But God, during this time, did protectively watch over them. That's my belief. Did I have another hand? Okay. I just sometimes see movement, and I don't know how precise it was. Okay, let's take a look at Joel. And you need to just go back a little further. Just ahead of Amos. Now, Joel will be that book that really focuses in on the day of the Lord. And that's really the major theme. Again, a lot of discussion about whether Joel was written very early or more in the time of Habakkuk and Zephaniah and Jeremiah. I lean toward the latter, but I'm not strongly contentious about that. But whatever it was, he's talking about the demise or punishment that's going to come to Judah. And he uses a phrase or a concept, the day of the locust. And then we'll see the day of the Lord. And if you look in chapter 1 of Joel, start with verse 3. Tell ye your children of it, and let your children tell their children and their children another generation, that which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left hath the cankerworm eaten, and that which the cankerworm hath left hath the caterpillar eaten. Now this is talking about some great pestilent ravaging of the land. Some people think this is fully symbolic and just talking about the Lord's going to come. I tend not to take that view. I think there probably was a great pestilence that came over the land. And he's going to describe that pestilence and then say, well, just like that happened, so the day of the Lord is coming. Now, the pestilence, I think we're going to see from the following verses, was the eating of their grapes. It doesn't say that here in verse 4, but when you look at the phrases in verse 5, awake, you drunkards, and weep. Well, what would make the drunkard weep? Well, somebody ate his grapes, so he won't have any wine. You know, he just used a little bit of logic there. And howl, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. So this pestilence of locusts and cankerworms came in and apparently just wiped their vineyards out. And if you're prone to drink, that would be a terrible thing. Verse 7 gives us another clue. He hath laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. He hath made it clean bare and cast it away. Another clue is down in verse 9. The meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests and the Lord's ministers mourn. There apparently was an attack on the harbors and the grapes and maybe other things. And this led to a great calamity because they use these things even more than we do. And as the phrase drunkard would lament, they use them sometimes in ways that weren't good. But he's saying you need to gird yourselves up because just as this day of the locusts, as I'm referring to it, came, so will the day of the Lord come. Okay, now the references to day in the Lord kind of begin with verse 15. Alas for the day of the Lord is at hand. And then if you drop down to chapter 2, verse 1. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. Now, it's used several other places, but let's just talk a little bit about it. A lot of speculation and theories about what the day of the Lord is. And I'll give you my belief on the phrase. I believe the phrase day of the Lord means a day of the Lord punishing people for their actions, as opposed to simply one singular day. And let me explain to you a little bit why. In the last part of verse 1 of chapter 2, it says, For the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh or near at hand. And I think the day of the Lord there is referring to the Babylonian invasion of Jerusalem. But when you go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul says the day of the Lord will come. And there he's talking about the second return of Christ. So I think if you try to say the day of the Lord is only one event, as opposed to the day of the Lord is an event when the Lord is going to work and end great things, then you get into difficulty. And lest we get out of time, let's jump over to chapter 2, verse 28, because in chapter 2, verse 28, this is the famous passage that Peter quotes on the day of Pentecost. You remember in Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2, he quotes David and he quotes Joel. And he says, almost verbatim, in Acts 2, what Joel writes here in verse 28. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. Now, I hope you're familiar enough with Acts chapter 2. If you're not, make a note.